Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
10, 9, 8.
I think so.
7, 6.
You ready, Casey?
Five, yeah. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah,
go!
Let's see.
These guys want to go. They want to go to Nome.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod, the pageantry, the parade, the party. It started today in downtown Anchorage, sort of, we'll explain. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get too ceremonious, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod 2020 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media, and I'm joined again by Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon and Zachariah Hughes. Hello.
Hey, Casey.
Hey.
Do we need to explain what the ceremonial start is to people? I feel like we should, probably.
I think we've done it in past years, and so at this point, it's more or less a tradition.
I would describe the ceremonial start as maybe a cross between a parade and a circus and a race. It's 11 miles along city trails and city streets. It's lined by spectators who are cheering and taking photographs and giving high fives and handing out hot dogs and brownies and beer and a lot of other things.
Yeah, I would say it's kind of the way the Iditarod Trail Committee has decided that it's going to do a couple of things. And one is give the public in Anchorage the best chance to see mushers that most of them are going to get. It's also a way for a lot of the Iditarod's corporate sponsorship to have a central place with lots of TV cameras and photos and viewing, and for all the stakeholders to get out in one highly visible choreographed place.
Yeah, it's like they shut down Alaska's largest city, the downtown core of it anyway, and dump a bunch of snow in the street, which is sort of backwards from what they do all winter.
A lot of the time we're complaining about how they're not taking the snow out of the streets fast enough.
Yeah, so here they are dumping snow in the street to make this dog sled course that goes, like Tegan said, through the downtown streets. It is down 4th Avenue, hangs a right on Cordova, goes south from there, and pretty much right south of 15th or 16th Avenue, you're on the city trails. And yeah, there's these parties that pop up along the trail and people sort of have their spots. There's like the actual trail gate people that they have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's sort of this big party thing. We're actually going to have what we call an audio postcard from our fellow reporter at Alaska Public Media, Liz Ruskin, who's actually our Washington, D.C. reporter.
We flew her to Alaska to report on the hard facts of Trailgate.
Yeah, the parties. And Liz is from Anchorage, and so it's, you know, she comes back to visit, and this is a good event for her to come back to see. So the mushers are, of course, they're all different people, and they have all these different personalities and different ways of dealing with the pomp and circumstance of the ceremonial start. We all talked to a bunch of them, and we've pulled some of our favorite pieces of tape from that. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. A big thing I was asking people about, and most of what I heard back, was just about the forecasted trail conditions. And everything we've heard so far has been about how deep the snow is. At some points, it's been compared to just a trench kind of dug into the snow by snow machine traffic going back and forth, trying to keep it open. So one of the people I talked to was 79-year-old Jim Lanier, who's the oldest musher on this year's Iditarod. And in previous years, he has been known to gear up in these somewhat technically flamboyant configurations of body armor and helmets and stuff like that to avoid, you know, when you, if you fall, not break his arm. And he's an older gentleman, even though he's very young at heart. And this year I sort of asked, hey, you gonna be wearing those, you know, motocross pads you wore a couple years ago? And this is what he told me.
I'm not even wearing a helmet this year because we're mushing in fluff, you know. You know, there's a, for hundreds of miles, it's a trench, I think, from Squintnet to the Yukon River. And I'm calling it trench warfare. That's what it's going to be out there. Yeah.
Trench warfare.
I like that.
In the fluff.
Because it's a trench. What's Jim Lanier's deal this year, too? There was a minor bit of controversy. I don't know if you could even call it that, but...
It was called ageism by some people. Jim Lanier has been the oldest musher in the field many times, and it had been a couple of years since he'd finished. He'd scratched multiple times, and about 2 years ago, there was an incident where he got into some trouble pretty close to the finish in Nome. Another musher had to come and kind of rescue him in really bad weather, and they both were in pretty serious trouble and had to call for help. At that point, Iditarod officials asked him to, said, if you want to compete again, you've got to requalify, which means going out and doing everything an original rookie has to do to be eligible to run, which is finishing 750 miles of approved races. So Jim Lanier, in his later 70s, went out and did the Yukon Quest and did the Kuskokwim 300 and did the Northern Lights 300 and is requalified and said this year he feels great. He feels really ready to race.
He's back in the Iditarod. And I think it beat up out there too. I mean, he's had injuries. There's a reason why he wears all those pads when the snow's a little harder.
And, when it's not just fluff outside.
Yeah, fluff. Fluff in the trench. Okay, so that's Jim Lanier. Who's up next?
The other person that I spoke with who had some comments that I liked was Alan Eichens, who mushes, he's based in Wasilla, but he mushes a lot up in the valley. And he summed up what I think a lot of mushers also will tell you if you talk at length about a plan and how are you getting ready for deep snow and the stuff that on paper is great. And he said, look, the fact of the matter is it's probably going to keep snowing. If it snows, who knows what the trail's going to be like? Who knows what we're going to do, your position, and whether you're leaving in front of somebody or behind somebody, all that'll have to get figured out on the fly. So this is how he put it.
You know, it you never know. They say, you know, we hear that it's going to be soft and lots of snow, and what they hear now is changes by the time I get there.
So I think there's a lot of people who are in the same position, and it's not just playing it safe by not trying to say where they're going to be. I think especially given how much snow there's been and the possibility, the very likely possibility that more will come, everybody's just sort of saying, we'll have to figure it out, and there's nothing you can really do other than do it.
So that's Alan Eichens basically saying, you know, we'll figure it out when we get there. We just need to be prepared to change on the fly what we're doing to keep on mushing down the trail. But of course, there's last year's champion, Pete Kaiser. Tegan, you talked to him. What did he say?
I did talk to Pete today, and I was definitely interested to talk to him. I haven't spoken with him since he won the Iditarod last year, so it was nice to hear about what he's been doing since then. And so we talked about kind of a host of things over, I don't know, a short amount of time, 5 minutes, and that included how the Iditarod has changed his life, if at all, which I thought was kind of interesting. He said, you know, we're trying to stay grounded. We live in the same house in Bethel. Our kennel is in the same spot. And so I kind of have more speaking engagements and more obligations, but in a lot of ways, life is just the same. And also what's the same largely is his team this year. He said he's bringing back all of the 8 dogs that finished the Iditarod with him last year, and then plus a few others. And there's 4 dogs that ran with his handler last year that will be on his team. So veteran dogs. He said they know each other really well. And then in terms of snow and strategy, he said a lot of what Alan said, and that was that it's kind of hard to plan ahead of time. You've got to go out there and take it day by day. I'll let him say it.
Strategy will definitely change, but it won't change now. It'll change as we get out there and as we see what it actually is, because a lot of times you get pre-race forecasts and it's the opposite of what they say it is, and so it's kind of hard to think I'm going to do this because this is what I've heard the trail is going to be like. So you really got to just get out there and be flexible and able to react to what the weather's doing, what the trail's like in front of you, and just take it one mile at a time.
One thing Pete did say really confidently is when I asked him what his goal was for this year, he said it is definitely to win again. So it'll be interesting to see how this race plays out.
Just Mr. Mellow all the time. I mean, he's always been like that.
I did a little like profile about him last year when it appeared that he was going to win the race. And I remember folks from Bethel saying, just, you know, kind of commending him for how studious he's always been, that he has like notebooks upon notebooks of notes that he re-watches race tape and analyzes it and figures out what he can do better or what he can do worse. I thought that was really interesting and kind of speaks to Pete's character and what he does. Yeah.
Tegan, who else did you talk to?
I also talked to Karen Hendrickson, and she was relaxing, laying in her sled bag before taking off for the ceremonial start. And we talked about a number of things, including the training season. She talked about that it was tough this year. At first, there wasn't enough snow in November and December, and then there was almost too much snow. So she said she didn't really get in as much training as she would have liked. You know, we talked about the deep snow to expect on the trail. And Karen brought up the wildlife concerns that we've heard about.
I think everybody's going to be running shorter and resting more often just because it's going to take longer to go. And other than that, the main concern really is just that the moose are really struggling in the deep snow. And they become very dangerous for us out there when they're on our trails, and they, you know, they get aggressive when they see dog teams. So that's the main thing I think a lot of us are thinking about is dealing with wildlife.
And this is how Karen said that she is prepared to deal with wildlife.
Yeah, I carry a firearm most years, but I definitely wouldn't leave one behind this year.
And I heard that from a number of mushers today that they were planning to pack a firearm to potentially prepare for moose, which will be interesting because I have not, in, you know, whatever the past 4 years covering it, have not really heard about moose on the trail or moose interactions. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I guess the thing is you don't want to run into one of the more ornery moose out there that wants to get in your face. I ran into a rather ornery fellow.
Perfect segue.
By the name of Mitch Seavey. And, you know, we talked about all the kind of the standard things, the snow. We talked about, you know, what he thinks about the competition out there and how his training season has gone. And he trains out of Sterling when he can. And this year there's been enough snow to do that. He, like a lot of people, didn't need to like travel away from home to find good training grounds. One of the questions that I asked him was sort of an alteration of a question that we ask, which is, you know, what keeps you coming back to the race? And I kind of went off from there and I said, what would it take for you to not come back to the race? And I picked this piece of tape because I think sometimes we want the funny, like lighthearted piece of tape. And this is definitely not that.
What would it take for you to not be running the Iditarod?
Well, this is not a time to talk about that. But I keep racing because I love the dogs. I love to see them perform. I love to see them get to do what they're born and bred to do. There's nothing more exhilarating than the joy that they exude when we're running down the trail. So it's something I'm just fascinated with.
Not thinking about ever retiring. I mean, not at this point, huh?
It's not a question for today.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Thanks for talking.
The mystery remains.
You know, it's like a little awkward, but I kind of love that, you know, because it's like we get to like put these headphones on and like stick a microphone in people's faces. And like, you know, he gave me the answer that he wanted to give. But I'm curious, like, how long is this guy going to keep doing it? How long are any of these people going to keep doing it? I mean, Jim Lanier's still in the race. Mitch Seavey's been doing this since he was a kid. Maybe he just like really doesn't want to think about ever retiring.
And... Well, I think also just like you hear it in the first part of that, the answer, like, I mean, this is an endurance sport. It takes a ton of like mental fortitude. And I don't know. I think to somebody like me that catastrophizes all the time, it's like, a number of things could keep me from coming back, like financial bankruptcy, a meteor, you know, any number of psychic collapse on my part. But I think for people that have to like, you know, prepare to be mentally tough, to not quit, to just push on, to sort of trust that if I can get to the next mile marker, then maybe I can get to the next one. I think there really is like a reticence and a need to kind of block out some of that catastrophizing or worst case scenario building. So I don't know, like, I get why he wouldn't want to answer that question on the parade day.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to think about all those things when you're just doing the parade day thing. Mitch is who he is, and I think that's kind of why I asked him that question. I was like, I know he's kind of surly, right? Like, we know that he's going to say this. Somebody out there who is definitely not surly at all, but had this spotlight thrust on him and I thought was really dealing with it very well, was Sean Underwood, who is Jeff King's handler, who, of course, is taking the A-team out now. Like we said, he's taking the Ferrari, Lamborghini, whatever, dad's hot rod just got handed to him. And he is a rookie. He's only ever done a 300-mile race before, but he's worked with these dogs quite a bit. Sean's going to be the counterpoint to my awkward question with Mitch Seavey. Because, again, I asked him about all that stuff. he was in the middle of getting interviewed by the official Iditarod media folks and getting his picture taken by Jeff Schultz, the official Iditarod photographer, with like this backdrop behind him, you know. And so we did kind of like the normal interview thing. We talked about all those issues that have kind of come up for him and being thrust into this role. But he also has like a really great head of hair. Like he's got this like flowing curly hair. I think one of our fellow reporters said that people on the trail were referring to him as Jesus and just has this like long hair. So here's what I asked him about that.
Do you feel like you have an advantage with this awesome hair that will keep you warmer maybe?
Oh man. You know, it's been fun growing out my hair. I grew up with a buzz cut, or my dad combed my hair every day, every morning when I was, you know, in elementary school, and didn't know I was gonna get this curly.
You didn't know, huh?
I didn't. It's straight when it's short, and so I grew it out, and after about 3 inches, it starts to get really, really curly. But yeah, I love the flow, and it does help me, you know, keep warm, and it's kind of like having an extra ruff, you know. Uh-huh. Somebody on social media was like, last minute rookie might be the winner for best hair. I was like, all my dreams. No.
Is it like part of your transition from going from like Georgia to, being, you know?
This is exactly how a Georgian would think. You're going up to Alaska, you see, you know, these rugged individuals, and the first thing I thought was I need to grow my beard out and I need to grow my hair out. And so I did those things, and actually Jeff's daughter, Ellen, she's always like, Sean, just fake it till you make it. So I showed up here and I got my hair grown out and a beard grown out so that maybe all these hard Alaskans would see me and not think I was so green. So after a few years, I don't need the hair as much to disguise myself. I feel pretty competent out here.
It's like this throwaway question, you know? Like, I'm just joking around.
That was so sweet.
And he has a great answer.
That was awesome.
Yeah, like, it made him feel more Alaskan.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
Maybe one day I'll be tough enough that I don't need a beard and this long hair to hide who I really am.
And he's kind of saying towards the end there, like, now I'm here. Like, I don't need to fake it. I got this awesome long hair, but like, I'm here. I am a dog musher. I'm about to do the Iditarod. It like really seemed like this moment or something.
Yeah. You really got to his identity.
Yeah.
I liked
it. The hair question. Yeah. Who knew?
We should start asking that more often.
Yeah. But we were talking about what our favorite pieces of tape are.
Casey, what's your favorite piece of tape from today?
Well, it's the piece of tape where I got on the back of Quince Mountain's runners and his sled to actually like do the ceremonial start with him. And it was amazing. I mean, it was like, I can't believe this is happening. I kind of still can't believe that it happened.
Because what are the ways that you get to ride in somebody's sled at the ceremonial start?
You're either a handler friend of theirs who they need basically for ballast, because they take 12 dogs in the ceremonial start, not the full 14. They need somebody sort of weighing the sled down. So you might be just some extra weight on the sled, but the people that ride in the sled bag like pay a lot of money to do that. They bid on those seats to ride and have beers and hot dogs and things handed to them. And so to have had the opportunity to do this was incredible. And, you know, I feel like we should say, you know, Quince at this point, because of his participation in the podcast last year, and we've just gotten to know him, we're like buds now, right? Like, I mean, he's part of our little gang here. We actually sat down, Quince and I sat down for an interview yesterday. Of course, we're recording this on Saturday, the day of the ceremonial start in Anchorage. And so on Friday, we sat down and we talked for like 90 minutes about all kinds of different things, about his past, about being on the reality show Naked and Afraid, you know, a little bit about dog mushing too. So we're going to be putting an extended cut of that here on the Iditapod as soon as I edit that extended cut down to something a little bit more manageable. And so one of his mentors, Ramey Reddington, was going to be the person to ride on the back of the sled. And I guess this morning, Ramey got up and didn't feel real well. We had actually talked about this a few days ago as like a possibility, but I didn't think like for real it was going to happen. And I think at some point this last week, he texted me like, that whole tag sled thing, not a sure thing. And it turned out the reason for that was that the back handlebar had been broken off, and you know, they had to fix that, which Ramey did with like a piece of sled runner. So the actual handlebar I was holding onto was like this kind of flimsy thing. And then I had my microphone in one hand.
So let me just ask, like, so it must be really cool when you're standing on the runners and there's all this hubbub and you're waiting to go. You've covered the Iditarod a bunch of times. You've covered tailgate parties all along. Like, you know better than most what the ceremonial start and the race itself is like. But this is like, nobody I know has ever gotten to report on what the loop through town. So like, was it just a party that you got to travel between the entire time, or what was it like?
Well, Quince, we talked afterward and he sort of described it, and I agree with his description. It's sort of different and it's broken up the whole way. So when you start out in downtown, like there's thousands of people watching. There's the Iditarod Insider videographer. There's the guy from Channel 2 with his, they're shooting live video that's going straight to TV. And there's the circus going on all around you. And I would say it's like watching a movie that you've seen before, but you're having a dream that you're in the movie. The thing that really still sticks out to me for some reason, and it's really simplistic, is that we pull out of that side street, we get onto Fourth Avenue, and it's like we're looking straight at the start banner. You know, from every other race I've ever been down there to cover, you're looking at that start banner from the side. And we're like moving up the street in that like parade of dog teams taking off every 2 minutes. And we're looking straight at it, and it's getting closer and closer. And of course, Quince is just like totally cool and calm the whole time. And then all of a sudden, it's like the start banner's above us. And then, you know, they count you down, 3, 2, 1, and you go. Anyway, that's enough of my description. Here's what it sounded like.
We're at the starting line now. Quince is going up and patting the dogs, getting them all ready.
Mountain, Wisconsin.
Getting the dogs all stoked up.
Actually, worked for Savies Iditarod during the summer, so you could learn more. I recommend other aspiring new mushers learn by working for a
Thank you so much for your work.
10, 9, 8,
I think so.
7, 6,
you ready, Casey?
5,
yeah.
4, 3, 2, 1, go! Let's see. Bob Schmidt joins us for Iditarod 48.
All right. Yeah. These guys want to go. They want to go to Nome. Hey.
We take off and there's like this pretty hard 90 degree right turn onto Cordova Street from 4th Avenue that's like sort of the first thing that you're kind of worried about, maybe falling off the sled. And I've done like a little bit of dog mushing, but not with 12 dogs and, you know, in front of thousands of people.
In a busy street, holding a microphone, shivering.
Holding a microphone with one hand and like the sled with the other. But it's like, it's kind of more of like a balance thing. And so we made it around that corner fine. I thought like, this will be fine. And I cannot tell you how many high fives there were. I couldn't really do too much high-fiving with the microphone in my hand, but like Quince is high-fiving kids and adults. People are shouting like, go Wisconsin. Like there were a ton of people that just had looked him up or know who he is and were like giving him Wisconsin props or talking about the Green Bay Packers. People, because of the way the berms are on the side of the trail, they kind of have to lean in. And if you're just like a little kid, you know, your arm's not that long. So parents are holding on to like their other arm so that the kid can like lean out on the trail and give you a high five. There was one person that was just completely holding the child horizontally like a guitar or something, you know, just like extended the child out for the high five.
Take my boy. Yeah.
So then we continue down south down the trail. Pretty soon after that, we get to what's called the Trailgate Party. And that's, I don't know, I mean, 300 people maybe or more. They hand out koozies. The koozie this year, the design, it said, Iditarod Trailgate, hindsight is 2020. And it had a picture of like a dog's butt, you know, because that's what the mushers are looking at the whole time. We pull up to the trailgate and this is what that sounded like.
Oh, wow. Look up there!
So at this point, they're squirting quote unquote diphtheria serum into Quince's mouth. Well, now we are joined by our reporter for the Trailgate parties, all the people enjoying themselves along the way. It's Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin.
So I started off at 11th and Cordova, which was a nice, very sweet neighborhood thing. And then I moved to the Chester Creek Trail near Lake Otis, where I ran into a group of neighbors from Airport Heights who call themselves Iditarod Kitchen. And they make it their mission to get hot dogs in the hands of mushers. It's a point of pride for them. And two things I want to point out before we play the postcard, which is notice what a nice guy Brent Sass is. You can hear him landing. And there's also another point in this where someone shouts, dog down. I just want to say this is a hot dog down. It was an incomplete pass.
Disclaimer. And
yes, yes. No dogs were hurt during the recording of this audio postcard.
All right. Here we go.
Oh, we live here down this alley, and all the neighbors get together every year. We come over here, we have a little barbecue stand, and we enjoy the race every winter. Yeah, and then since I speak French, we have a French guy, Nicolas Petit. He's my future victor. I have some chocolate for him.
My name is Emery. Best part is about the dogs running and how they have, like, how they can go all, like, from all the way to Willow to Nome. That's a long ways. It's like 1,000 miles or something.
Get in there. Get in there, Lucas. Remember, it's about the reach.
39. Tom Fogel. He's from Norway.
Norway, another Norwegian. Dog down? We have a dog down.
Look, mushers.
Almost all mushers. Yeah. When we first start, people grab a hot dog just to stay warm, don't you think? But then eventually everyone wants to give a musher a hot dog.
Because how many hot dogs can we really eat? But there's 50-some mushers.
And, I mean, that's a bucket list thing. I give a hot dog to a musher before the Iditarod? Yeah.
And it's fun. Stop.
Dogs up. Dogs up. Dogs up.
Here we go.
Hot dog!
I'll take a hot dog.
Hot dog, yes.
Thank you.
Guys, you guys got beers too?
We do. We just got one. Appreciate that. Okay, guys, you ready?
Good luck, Brent.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for being out here. Really appreciate it.
Good luck.
Awesome.
That was super great.
He's like, I got beers. I got hot dogs.
Beers, hot dogs. I'm set.
That is awesome.
That was super cool.
I think Mitch just came through. I think it's Robert Reddington.
It's who should be good. That's a big name.
Uh-huh.
I wonder who that is, Reddington-wise. We heard about an ice bar or something that's a bar carved into the snow, which sounds pretty awesome. But, yeah, I'm kind of limited to my worldview here. I've just got this right here. I think we make it not about us. We've made it more about the mushers and I don't know, I guess connecting with them. And yeah, like, well, and about the community too. Like, we're handing out the hot dogs to everybody.
Hot dog! She's drinking a beer.
I have to say, that was my first hot dog to a musher, and I feel alive. I am part of the Iditarod. If that person wins, I have a part of that. That was great.
All the rest of those regular ones?
Yeah, we could cook more, but I think
we're not going to go through. How's our propane doing?
It's good, yeah. Did we leave it in the car last night?
No, it's just really, I think it's just cold.
Yeah, so I have a ice cold bottle of propane on my belly to be able to keep the dogs flowing. That's right.
We still have like 10, like 8 more mushers.
Yeah, we're not done until the last musher leaves.
We're not done until the last musher leaves.
At my first stop in South Addition, I spoke to Philippe Clauert and Young Emery. And then in the Airport Heights crew, you mostly heard from Leanne and Lincoln Garrick and Rich and Allison Capitan.
I love that. You know, you can really hear the excitement, how much people really get into this race. And like the one guy said, you know, he handed a musher a hot dog, and if that guy wins, he had some part in it, you know, even if it's just this like ceremonial, untimed part of the race.
I just can't thank you enough for giving me a chance to do it.
Well, thank you for doing it, and we definitely appreciate the help here on the I Did It Pod. Another thing that we're always featuring here on the I Did It Pod are listener questions. We've gotten a few of those so far. I'll just say right now, if you want to send a question for a musher or for one of our reporters to try to answer, you can record those on a voice memo app. All iPhones have them. Other smartphones have them. You record yourself. Tell us who you are. Tell us where you are. Send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. That's iditarod@alaskapublic.org. It's a really cool way to get different voices on the show. We always appreciate those. We actually have our first listener question for IDITAPOD 2020. And here it is.
Hi, my name is Julie, and I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm really excited to listen to the I Did It Pod again this year, so thanks so much for all your hard work in advance. I know there are two different routes that the Iditarod can take. Can you explain which route the race is taking this year and the major differences between those routes?
First, Tegan, can you tell me what you were doing when she said she's from Pennsylvania?
I was raising the roof, as they say. I am also from Pennsylvania.
It's a big state. I hear.
It is a big state. I'm from Allentown, Pennsylvania, on the east side of the state.
So her question is, which route are they running and what's the difference?
I was actually just looking at a map of the trail. It's the section between Ophir and Caltag. And this year we're on the northern route. So it does this half circle to the north, and it's an even year. So that's why we're doing the northern route. And on odd years, they do the southern route. And so they do sort of a half circle to the south. The main difference is, I think generally we hear anecdotally that the southern route is maybe a little more sparse.
Martin Boozer called it hungry country last year, I think. The northern route, which goes through the kind of interior hub of Galena, is a different stretch of the Yukon River than on the southern route, traveling through some of the lower Yukon towns like Anvik and Shagaluk. So it reconvenes in Caltag and then along the coast. That's the same every year. The first third of the race is the same every year. So this is a great question because we kind of can throw out northern route, southern route really casually. It's been especially scrambled the last couple of years because there were some reroutes through Fairbanks, which is a non-traditional route, and then the southern route was used 2 years in a row to sort of make up for it. But as of right now, we are back to the even odd oscillation back and forth. So we're going through Ruby, Galena, couple other towns. They're a little higher up in the Yukon River on the northern route.
Judging by the growling stomachs in this room, I would say that we are all in hungry country ourselves. And I guess that's about all the time we have for today. Been joined by Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon and Zachariah Hughes. Tegan will probably be back. Zach, you're about to take off.
Yeah, I have to go home and start packing. And I also haven't gotten groceries yet.
Ah, yes.
So, yeah.
Time to start hoarding that ramen. All right, well, our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Was it what you expected and, like, you know, how wild and whatnot was that for you?
No, it wasn't wild. I mean, I just, the dogs are so familiar now at this point, and I just like being out with them and watching them, and so then it all becomes wonderfully routine, you know, and they have confidence, so I borrow from the dogs' confidence, and I don't know, I'm pretty chill. I don't get too worked up most of the time about things. Might be out of f*** to give, I don't know. But no, I don't mean that in a way to say I didn't. I mean, it's an incredible experience. I just don't get real nervous about stuff like this. I get more nervous about, like,
answering the phone or reading my mail or anything like that.